Hey, this is Chris D with Macro Ops, and this week it's a solo podcast. I wrote an article this week's Macro Musings, which, if you are unaware, is a weekly email put together by one of us at Macro Ops, and we usually bang out about five topics that we are focusing on. For me this week, I covered experiments in the art of breath, and in the articles I'm reading, and then let's see, the Avoidable War is a really big deep dive into the Honorable Kevin Rudd and how many speeches he's done this year about the U.S. and Chinese relations, and pretty much it is very close to well. We'll get into that here shortly. And then more important, more interesting thing I discovered was a tweet storm from Lux Capital's Josh Wolf, who kind of dug deep and succinctly in, I think it was about 5 to 10 tweets, show how China has taken over the U.S. film industry. From there, we covered the charts I'm looking at, which was a Fed trade, and also a big inflow into the bond ETF, books I'm reading. I'm rereading the quants, and mostly that was based off of just my interest in quantitative trading. Podcasts I'm listening to, Hardcore History, I'll get into that for a little bit, and trades I'm considering, a long euro trade. Finally, I close it with a quote from Charlie Munger, since yesterday was quite the Charlieisms day. I figured I would bring his back. And why not? In the markets, basically everybody quotes either Warren Buffett or Charlie Munger. And if they quote that, then it's certainly right. There's no other logic that could possibly be. Tongue in cheek, I say. All right, clear my throat. Coincidentally, we'll start with the experiments in the art of breath. This is written from a guy named Brian McKenzie, who is I came across him from CrossFit Endurance back in my CrossFit heavy days. He's a ultra marathoner and very much focuses with a lot of high-level athletes in getting them into their best performance state. Also, Jason Donaldson and Rachel Colasino, I believe, is how that one's pronounced. And it's very interesting because, I'll just read the quote. There are side effects as well, referring to heavy breathing, or hit this article here. The side effects include less heavy breathing. In other words, you can breathe a lot better. Calmer beings, as in you're a much more calm and relaxed person, and better sleep. And what they're referring to is nasal breathing, so not the big mouth breathing like we sometimes are, but actually forcing into the nasal breath. And the reason that they find that's really important is a heightened utilization of carbon dioxide. And what that does, when you're more of a nasal breather, you enact the parasympathetic, which is the downregulation. It gets you to a point of calmness. Also, if you can utilize nasal breathing as opposed to mouth breathing, you're far more efficient at utilizing that carbon dioxide in your system. Also, it's not natural. Kind of, if you look back and look how your body's built, you have these nose hairs, right? You have hairs in your nose, and their whole job is to filter things out so that you, when you breathe things in through your nose, it enacts your parasympathetic system, calms you, helps you recover. You're actually getting in better oxygen when you're exercising, when you're breathing through your nose. It takes a lot of work, though. A lot of people, if you're not a high-level athlete, you spend a lot of time breathing through your mouth and, you know, recovering. Let's say you're jogging up a hill or you are running sprints. Usually when you're winded, you're really huge, massive amounts of oxygen you're trying to get back into your bloodstream. But if you can force your nose, the breathing through your nose, you're going to, just so obvious as I'm doing it right now, I'm so aware of it, but it really does improve your oxygen uptake and recovery. So in other words, you could run that sprint. If you can do it through your nose as opposed through your mouth, you're going to recover quicker and probably last a little bit longer in it. So the article isn't too long. It's actually very short. But what it does is at the very end, there's a nice little experiment you can do on yourself. And I've been doing this for the last week and working on the differences. The experiment is basically exhale your breath, hold your breath, and count how long it takes. It's a very simple experiment. Exhale, hold your breath, just don't inhale again and see how long it takes. A score of less than 10 seconds or less is a problem. It means your ability to retain CO2 is very low. So what you want is that CO2 in your body, right? So if that's high levels in your body, you don't need to breathe. A score of 10 to 20 seconds, pretty normal these days. That's not a good thing, apparently. 20 to 30 is getting better and above average. 40 seconds is the goal, and that's where you really want to be. And I think everybody here in Alex, Tyler, and myself, we've all do or have done Wim Hof. We're all meditators. We're all athletic types as well. And the Wim Hof method, in essence, you do 30 to 35 deep inhales and then exhale. And then, in other words, you just don't breathe in. You count how long it takes for you to breathe back in. So like that, 30 times. And by the time you're at 30 breaths, you're so hyper-oxygenated that you don't need to breathe. And sometimes, that can be 30 to 60 seconds. I've gone over a couple of minutes. So if you do 30-second round, count your time, and then start up another 30-second round, count your next breath hold time. And then after your third time, you can usually get up into the 2 or 3 minute mark before you're even needing a breath. It's a little uncomfortable when you, believe it or not, when you're inhaling 30 times in a row, it kind of, you get warm. You get really warm. This also works, Wim Hof, we do, or I do my cold showers or bath in the morning. And when you're doing the breathing work, when you're doing the breath work, just if I was to wake up and just drop into the cold shower, that's dramatic. I do it often without the breath work. But if I go ahead and do, usually it's like a 2 to 4 minute shower, and I'm up in the mountain lair where we have about 3 to 4 feet of snow on the ground outside, and the water coming out of the shower head is real close to frozen, especially when it's negative 10 Fahrenheit outside. But I'll wake up and sometimes I'll just go straight to the shower, and that hits you like just it takes your breath away. And that's the goal, is to be able to absorb it and not lose your breath, not react, just acknowledge that it's cold water on you. Now, when I do the breathing prior to it and then go take a shower, I have zero problem sitting in there for 5 or 10 minutes and just getting pummeled by cold water. It's no problem. So breathwork is a very interesting new place that has a lot of interesting opportunities, especially in that most people, when we're talking about performance, and it's not just physical performance we're talking about, as we're all in the market here, and we make one bad decision, that can cost a lot of money. And not making a good decision can also cost a lot of money. So this is all just adding to that stack to make us better decision makers, better traders, better investors. And this is just another tool. And it's been really interesting to spend some time on the breath. I've been spending the last few months very heavily focused on this. So from there, another article I'm reading was I'm reading a collection of speeches by Kevin Rudd. And there's a link to it. It's called the Avoidable War, basically between the United States. The year 2018 represented a fundamental turning point in U.S.-China relations. While the trade war between the world's two largest economies drew much of the headlines, a deeper rift was brewing. After 40 years of strategic engagement, during which the United States welcomed China into the international order and supported its economic development, the Trump administration called for a new era of strategic competition. Simultaneously, much of the Chinese political establishment was adopting the view that the United States sought to contain China's rise. There's a great, there's a great book called by Graham Allison from Harvard. It is Destined for War, and it really talks about the Thucydidean trap, where you have, and it's very much like the United States rising as a supernova during the late 1800s, post U.S. Civil War, and the United Kingdom, in essence, if we look at the parallel, China would be the United States, and the United States currently would be Britain. How that superpower is so focused. There's the job of the existing superpower is to, there's a lot of management of a lot of moving parts, whereas the supernova uprising is wholly focused on growth. And each successful step in that growth, that ladder through growth, further threatens their relationship with the superpower. And, you know, obviously World War I, World War II, that shift was where the United States really dominated. And currently you can see the United States is in a lot of different rifts. Venezuela is an interesting one coming up, where China doesn't have to do anything. China just has to stand by and wait for the opportunity. And anyway, this gets into that quite a bit, which is a lot of fun. I love this subject quite a bit. But Josh Wolfe, who's actually an even more interesting take on this, and though reading 18 different speeches is enjoyable, it takes some time and a lot of contemplation. Josh did, let me count just to, in, here we go, 13 tweets. Josh was able to succinctly demonstrate how China has pretty much dominated the U.S. film industry. And I'm going to just kind of read through his points as their tweets. It doesn't take a lot of time for me to just read it. So in a preview, this is basically what he's about to say. In preview, it is to raise your awareness of how savvy and sophisticated China is and how naive we can be as something happens right in front of our eyes. And then he goes into some history. In the 1980s, the U.S. had a clear geopolitical and ideological opponent. To consolidate a populace, you need a central messaging, a zeitgeist to rally around, a common enemy to focus upon. Our 1980s rallying medium was Hollywood, and that was the movie Red Dawn, which this will become a little more clear. The next example is Rocky IV in 1985. Where Rocky Balboa fights Dolph Lundgren. Red Dawn is Russians invaded the United States and a handful of kids took them on. Wolverines. And then there's Firefox, where Clint Eastwood is a fighter pilot and the common enemy is a certain union. Bond versus KGB's Anatoly and License to Kill. And The Living Daylights, both 1987-1989. And for kids, we were indoctrinated by the flag-waving American great Hulk Hogan versus the communist Soviet Nikolai Volkov. Russian villains were everywhere. Today, history may repeat, but China was damned if it would rhyme. So before I ask the question, where are the Chinese villains? In 2012... for $2.6 billion, China acquires AMC Theaters. and 1.2 billion to buy out Carmike Cinemas, passing number one Regal Entertainment. They paid $1 billion for Dick Clark Productions, Golden Globes, American Music Awards. They paid $350 million for Voltage Pictures, famous for Hurt Locker. They paid $3.5 billion for Legendary Entertainment. It's got John Wick, most notably. and then the latest news, pulling a film for technical reasons, really means China Bandit. And let's see if I can pull out the... 1 second is the movie that's been pulled out, and it highlights a Chinese villain. So, have you noticed, like a magician's trick, where have all these Chinese villains gone? Can you name one? Textbook brilliantly executed information operations right in front of our eyes. Now you know. And then there's a link. Finally, he has a link to another succinct article, or I'm sorry, a YouTube video that goes back to where about in 2012, I believe, is when any Chinese villains, weakness, anything that had to do with China not being held in the most superior light has pretty much been sucked out of all of Hollywood. So interesting. Very interesting to think about. All right, so some charts I'm looking at. There's a blog out there called Quantifiable Edges, and being a fellow quant, I'm always interested in finding looking at how other quants come into their trading ideas and how they, you know, what they look at, what the results are. So he has a backtest on the S&P 500 on Fed announcement days. Typically, it was a two-day meeting, and you know, they announced the result on the second day. And he backtested all the way back to 1979 when Paul Volcker was the chairman of the Fed. So the test started with a $100,000 account and made $82,000 over the course of 79, 30, 40 years, right? a 40-year backtest, that's pretty solid. Profit factor 1.98. So anything above one means you're profitable. And that's about a 57% profitability. 183 winning trades, 135 losing trades, total 318 trades. And it averages on a $100,000 position, it averages $260.48 per trade. And anyway, it's very interesting. But the interesting part that I saw, and he also highlighted, was that up until our last Fed announcement, a week or two weeks ago, at the time of this, is when it was the first time, I don't know how many more times or whatever, where the Fed decided not to raise rates and they were going to look at being more dovish. So for the first seven announcements, the market was down. So this strategy basically goes long the S&P 500 on Fed day. So I'd probably just buy the open, sell the close. However, he does have the specifics of the back test on his site, and I'm just ballparking it. So it is interesting that Powell, every single Fed announcement day, lost money on that trade, buy the open, sell the close, except this last announcement. So another interesting thing of note, I did point in here, we didn't put a link to it or anything like that, but if you reach out to Tyler at macro-ops.com, he does run a Fed Day strategy, and he's a quant himself. He's got a pretty good strategy there that is back-tested, and probably he can spend some time on that with you. The next chart that I was looking at was very interesting, and it's the Vanguard Total International Bond ETF. And for the first, well, I guess it's month and a half now of 2019, $3 billion has flowed into the total now $16 billion fund. So at the time, we're looking at $13 billion and just the beginning of this year. One third of the fund's assets are in German bonds German and Japanese debt. So what that is, in my mind, that's a huge US dollar short. However, the thing that makes that interesting, first of all, everybody has this dollar short, dollar long argument, right? We're macro, so dollar's the most important currency out there, so probably doesn't get more macro than that. But the interesting thing here, since we had the government shutdown recently, we did not get the commitment of traders report. And, you know, some of the data that's been coming out has been rather slow and maybe dirty. I don't know. But Morgan Stanley was still in business and they're still doing their FX matrix. And it shows US dollar being the most crowded currency position of all. And then the Bank of America Merrill Lynch fund manager survey mentions that the three most crowded trades in their survey, long emerging markets, okay, total international bond ETF, that kind of falls in, right? Yeah. And then long US dollar as the second most crowded trade, and then long FANG and BAT, which if today's trading was any indication of that trade unwinding, it's NASDAQ, I believe, I just feel like checking the numbers. Well, at one point, the NASDAQ was flat while the Russell 2000 was up 1.5%. It looks like the NASDAQ did come back a little bit today, up about 0.67, whereas the Russell closed up near 2%. So a very interesting macro switch. It looks like a rotation out of tech. It's surprising that it's still this crowded, but I guess it makes sense. And it seemed like financials took a big amount. Also, another interesting thing today, we were up over 4.5% on RBOB on that futures contract. So, something to consider: if the most crowded trade out there, if everybody's bullish the US dollar, and the most crowded trade out there is a short, or not the most crowded, the second most crowded trade out there is long US dollar, according to fund manager survey and Morgan Stanley. And then we have this massive, like 25% increase in assets on the international, total international bond ETF. Something interesting's happening. There's some very interesting things taking shape. It could be hedge, who knows? But it's off the charts. So, again, the theme of quants. Citadel billionaire founder Ken Griffin has purchased the most expensive real estate ever, I believe, or in the United States. It's a $238 million New York City penthouse. $238 million for a penthouse apartment in New York City. This is good. This is great. Which got me reading the back to open up the book again, Quants, which is basically the story of how Ed Thorpe, Peter Mueller, James Simmons, Clifford Asness, Aaron Brown, and Boaz Weinstein all became quant traders, and kind of the stories of it builds up into I don't want to give away the ending too much, but it kind of builds up into the global financial crisis and how the quants almost ruined the world. So, and it also very much ties back to their big card games that they have in downtown Manhattan. But yeah, following the US dollar short thing that I mentioned on the crowded trade, my key takeaway from the book is about how crowded and therefore dangerous a crowded trade that is successful can be, because one glitch, meaning if something's really crowded, first of all, if something's successful, it eventually becomes crowded, right? Eventually, their job is to mine data, their job is to process data and come up with insights and then find these opportunities and just max out their exposure to it. And what does that mean? You have a very crowded trade and one change, you know, something, a blip from there, and it could take down everything. Because, I mean, just imagine how much processing and compute power these quant firms run, and then they're up against a glitch in their system that somehow might have been caused by the very system itself. Or maybe one of the big players in that field decides like, hey, I know how I can take a bunch of money from everybody else because they're in this crowded one, and they start hammering it really hard, and that forces liquidations, and that just causes some catastrophic moves. It's interesting to think about. So I like long form podcasts. I listen to nearly every Joe Rogan podcast. Not everyone. There, some of them are hard to get through. I like Tim Ferriss podcasts, and I really like Shane Parrish's The Knowledge Project from Farnham Street Blog fame. They all have great people on. They have great discussion, ask great questions, and it's always interesting. I get great ideas from those, and usually from those that leads me down a path to something else, and then I just start going down these interesting rabbit holes that turn out to be extremely, extremely useful. But I also find myself up in the Montana mountains, and I have it's slow paced, it's quiet, there's nature everywhere. My usual hiking trail when the snow's gone and I'm actually here is probably about a 30 minute jog sort of trail. However, with 3 to 4 feet of snow on the ground and you know, a fresh 6 inches every day, that 30 minute jog takes me probably 3 to 4 hours. So I have a lot of time out there just being able to either listen to the snow, listen to my footsteps in the snow, or listen to some podcasts. And, you know, to be honest, I'll do both. Sometimes I'll just enjoy the silence, but other times I really enjoy getting into a subject and going really deep. It's somewhat, it's a lot more fun to start a podcast that I know that I'm not going to be able to finish before I'm dead. And Dan Carlin is the, a legendary storyteller. I'll tell you what, his stuff is, it is the top. Every single episode, it's hardcore history. Now, Dan is a journalist. Dan's not a historian. However, he, if you want to look at it by trade, but by what he actually contributes, what he actually does, you know, he reports history. And each episode is about 5 hours. It is an investment. I got to warn you, if you're looking for a quick podcast to get into, that's not it. If you're looking for like Ken Burns' World, The Greatest War Ever, if you enjoyed that, then the blueprint for, it's a 5-part series. So we're looking at, you know, 20 to 30 hours of podcast, just audio. So it really focuses on the Somme in World War One, and you know, World War One was about trench warfare. That was the most notable thing at that time, and it was a preview. It was called the War to End All Wars, but it was a preview to World War Two, obviously. So, again, it's highly addictive if you are a fan of history. It really gets you to the point to where just a single battle, a single time in history that was so big in history. It's just a very interesting podcast. If you're looking for, and they're free, at least for a period of time, then eventually he closes them down and you have to buy them. Each, you're looking at five basically, you know, audiobooks, but well worth the time to spend on that. Also, you know, Shane Parrish's podcast is wonderful. So a trade I'm considering, which almost, when I woke up this morning after I put this one out, almost looked like it was dead before it even started. And that's part of how I like to trade. I won't enter a trade until the trade has moved in my direction. And so I'll enter on what's called a buy stop as opposed to a limit order or something. And I need a price. This was a long order. This is a buy of the Euro USD. And I needed it to move above the previous bar to convince me that it could be a successful trade. And so I basically put a buy order in at 1.13100, and it would have been, you know, the stop was 1.2490, which we actually went down. We traveled down below that level. And then somewhere middle of the day, U.S. trading session, it turns on a dime and rallies up near the top of nearly the entry price. So the trade hasn't been filled yet, still what's called an inside bar. However, to be clear, I am a quant type trader. I do swing trading. I'm not looking for intraday quick pops. When I do trade intraday, but this is my main business is this swing trading. And most of the time they are mean reversion type trades. So we're not looking for a move from 1.131 to 1.3. You know, I'm not looking for that big of a move. I'm just looking for, you know, maybe up to the 1.14.5 area, maybe 1.115 area. That's a pretty good move. That's a week or two worth of travel for a Forex market, but it's not the big macro trades that are, you know, the big calls out there. My trades are meant to have an edge that I can exploit, where I can pop in and take a chunk out of it, you know, take my pound of flesh and then get away. Now, that being said, I am a macro trader, global macro trader. And so this is my method to get into the big macro moves. And it's definitely a technical quantitative strategy to do it, as opposed to thinking through interest rates and tightening and easing and politics. It's more of a focus of what is everything doing? How does it, you know, who are the big players in macro? Okay, that's my universe of tradable products. And then I just wait for the opportunity. So the way I actually get in on the big macro moves is something like this happens. I get in on this little, it drops down, it goes up, it drops down, it goes up. And a trade like this happens. And next thing I know, I'm catching a big runner. And instead of just, you know, waiting for the dollar to fall apart, I actually have a tradable entry to see a weak dollar here by going long the euro, short the dollar. And who knows if the weak dollar plays out? Who knows if a strong euro plays out? But I just have a higher than normal opportunity here. Anyway, that's how I tend to do it. And I only risk about 1%. So as I throw these trades up and, you know, I discuss them, a really big important part of it is risk management. If I'm going to take 100 to 200 trades a year, I need to be able to sit through all 100 to 200 trades. And I need to have enough dry powder to increase if this thing would turn into the dollar falling apart and the euro taking off to the 130 level or something, which, you know, that's a huge, massive macro bet. And, you know, there are only a couple of really big macro bets per year. So if this does turn out, at this point in time, it's just a regular trade to me. I'll probably be out within a week. However, if it does turn into the trade of the year, one of the two trades of the year, I have enough powder, dry powder, to continue to add to it. I don't know which of my 100 to 200 trades that I have set up this year are going to pan out. But what I do know is that I need to have enough capital to get into it when I have it correctly. And I'm not good at identifying the beginning of a very large macro move. I'm pretty good at identifying a short-term move that's tradable that I can pull out a little bit of cash, but I'm not optimized towards catching the long interest rates or, you know, short gold that runs as big as it, you know, those two trades did, as big as they did this last in 2017, 2018 timeframe. So as the position, if it does, I should say, move into the big macro bets that we're looking to get into, if I've only risked 1%, then I can continue to add to that along the way at more strategic points. And that's really important for my trading style, so that of the 200 trades, I may not actually get a single one of those trades this year, the big macro bets. I may not get it, but I'm going to take 200 attempts or so at it. And of those, if it does pay out, I'm going to catch a big one and I can just add to it and just pile on. And if it doesn't, I already know what my win rates are. I already know what my expectancy is. I know what to expect from this next year, as long as I am very disciplined and perfect in my execution of my rules. And that's what this trade is right here. This is just a great representation of what I get 2 to maybe 5 of these a week that I jump into. And it's just doing it well, entering in exactly the entry price with the correct type, a stop, not a limit, a good till cancel, not a mark or not a day, making sure it's a long, not a short. And most importantly, making sure my position sizing is correct, so that if something bad does happen, a big black swan event does happen, a big deal, drops me down a little bit, but I know that over the course of the year, it's going to continue on. So the entry is 113-100 stop on a daily close. Now that's also important in my back test, is going back and letting the daily bar close, not tick below, not travel down there. It has to close the day below the low. Today is a great example. We're doing this on February 15th on Friday. And again, the euro opened up just a straight red candle down below the low. And had I taken that stop, it turned right around. It moved right up to the top of the thing. So intraday, there's a lot of wackiness that happens, but I'm an end of day trader, so I don't mind. I will wait until the end of day happens and I don't have to risk it. And I'm also not in the trade. I had no heartburn today. I had no issues because I just sat there and went about my day and have my order in there. If it comes to me, it comes to me. If it doesn't, it still hasn't convinced me that it's ready for prime time. It hasn't convinced me that it's going to be the trade or even an entry that I'll fulfill before it cancels itself. All right. And because yesterday was Charlie Munger Day on Twitter, apparently, he was just kidding. He was at, doing his usual insulting people and telling them how stupid they are. But perhaps one of the smartest people we know. I just got my Poor Charlie's Almanac hardcover for the Montana residents because, well, I like to grab a small chunk of Charlie's wisdom from time to time and contemplate it because, yeah, if there's anybody out there who will make you feel stupid, Charlie is very good at that. And if there's a better task in life than to be told you're stupid but also be logical and not confrontational about it. He's really saying like, this is how you should think. So finding somebody to think like, or to help mentor you through books, I would say Charlie Munger is a pretty good one. And then so I'll stage his quote. It's a single line, but I want to preface it by saying, are you finding yourself watching Bloomberg, CNBC, Yahoo Finance, whatever, Real Vision, any of these places, and just yelling at the TV, screaming into Twitter at this is madness, Jay Powell's doing this, and I can't believe what Abe-san's doing, just yelling about it. Oh, this is so perfect. Yeah, VIX is up and S&P's up. That makes sense. Really, what that is saying is that the information you think you have is not the right information. If it doesn't make sense, you either don't have the right information or you've interpreted the information incorrectly as well. So here's Charlie. I think one should recognize reality even when one doesn't like it. Indeed, especially when one doesn't like it. If you're short the S&P from its December 26th lows or anywhere prior to that or anywhere since, and you're really expecting the market to go down, and it still hasn't. In fact, today it closed at, yet again, it's 2019 highs, not for the NASDAQ. It seems to me that maybe there's information you're not considering. I'm a big believer in finding the proper market regime and applying a strategy to that regime. And if it's not working, well, then something's off. And that doesn't mean that you need to bet harder or yell into Twitter louder. It means you need to adjust what you're actually doing. What are you doing that is wrong and causing the drawdown? Is ego the thing? I mean, let's say you're short S&P futures. Are you going to roll into March and we're still up and you're going to roll over into, you know, the June contract because you're going to be right and pay that amount over and over and just sit on it? Are you going to hedge? Are you going to step away? A number of different things. But if that's the case, well, your information is incorrect. That's all. Something out there doesn't add up to what you think it adds up to. And you don't like it. Well, that's best time to discover reality. All right, that's all I have this week. That is my macro musings, and in digital format, which would be, I guess, the other one's in digital format, in audio format. If you want to reach out to me, hit me up. I'm on Twitter, Chris D Macro, C-H-R-I-S, D as in Delta, Macro. Same on Instagram. Not nearly as big on any of the other socials. And or Chris at macro-ops.com. You can email me there. I don't promise worldly wisdom and amazingly witty responses, but I usually will respond. That being said, we are a month and a half into the pre-election year. There's some interesting data that shows this is one of the most bullish years of a presidential cycle, where the market typically is up nearly 32 to 33% from the market lows, previous market lows. We are currently up 17%, so there is another 15 to 16% potential higher. So don't get too complacent in expecting the downside to happen. Could very well happen. Maybe we could get even lower and then have to travel 32% from that low. So it could be a wild, wild year. And I will see you in the next recording.